The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
My little boy River was born at the height of the pandemic, and it just, I was weird. I'd hold him and look out at a world in lockdown. And I went and was covering the George Floyd protests after all of that upheaval, and just were like living through this revolution and pandemic and so much uncertainty. And so I started writing these Earth Day letters to my newborn about, hey, sorry that we broke the sea and the sky. Sorry that we've shortened the wings of the nightingale, but I'm still so glad you're here. And we need help. We need helpers these days. And these letters transformed into this book in which, you know, the title is based on the thought that life as I knew it growing up is gone. It's over. The Goldilocks Earth we grew up on, we're beyond that. Nobody knows for sure how this new planet works. But life as we know it can be is already being proven around the world is healthier and happier and more connected and more resilient.
And welcome back to the Writer Files. I am your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Emmy-winning TV journalist and CNN chief climate correspondent Bill Weir spoke to me about finding his beat, seeking hope in a changing world, and his debut, Life as We Know It Can Be. Bill's a veteran anchor, writer, producer, and host who joined CNN in 2013 after a decade of award-winning journalism at ABC News. After writing and hosting four seasons of the primetime CNN original series, The Wonder List with Bill Weir, he was named the first chief climate correspondent in network news in 2019. His debut book is Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Described as a positive and unabashed approach to exploring the science, politics, and human behavior that must be addressed to solve our most pressing problems. New York Times bestselling author and CNN anchor Jake Tapper said of the book, Bill provides insightful, alarming, but ultimately hopeful coverage of the climate crisis. His new book is a gorgeous love letter to his son, but also to Earth and humanity. And New York Times bestselling author Jonathan Safran Foer called it a clear-eyed, heartfelt argument against despair. In this file, Bill and I discussed how he incorporated the math and physics of storytelling into his journalism, the crappy elf method of writing and penning letters to his kids in the future, why connection is more important than ever in the golden age of distraction, the difference between writing for the screen and the page, when he decided to focus on the dreamers and the doers, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Okay, we are back on The Writer Files, and I'm honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. We have an award-winning journalist, CNN chief climate correspondent, and now author Bill Weir is hanging out with us. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this today.
Kelton, so great to talk writing with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more than writing to unpack here, of course. I know you got a lot of balls in the air and a lot going on, but I'm really excited to just kind of pick your brain for a minute. And yeah, I cannot wait to talk about Life as We Know It Can Be and kind of the inspiration behind it and yeah, all the things. But take us back a little bit, because I know that you have had this really fascinating circuitous career as a journalist and a veteran anchor, writer, producer, this fantastic TV show, The Wonder List with Bill Weir. I mean, so much in your past that has kind of shaped where you are today. But take us back a little bit. Do your okay. kind of superhero origins a little bit, because I know that, you know, storytelling has kind of shaped your your career and of course brought you to this tome.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, and I'm a big fan of trying to connect with each other in these divided times. And I think the best way to do that is just to say, what's your story? And, you know, lean across the fence, even if the, you know, yard sign of, and during election season is different than yours, you know, and really understand the, because we're made of stories. We're the products of the narratives we marinate in wherever we are. And so mine started in Milwaukee. My parents, dad was a cop, mom was a secretary. They split up when I was a baby. And then my mom became a very zealous evangelical Pentecostal Christian who announced at breakfast when I was about 9 years old that she'd had a dream from God and God wanted us to leave Milwaukee and move to Texas, where she could start to study and become a televangelist. And she put me on the phone with my dad, who had joint custody, and asked if we could move. And he let us, and the dreams kept coming. So I went to 17 different schools in 6 states from that age until I left home, and a lot in the Bible Belt. And then I'd go back and spend my summers and Christmases with my, you know, atheist dad, who was an outdoorsman. And it was this interesting upbringing where I was sort of on a pendulum between really extreme worldviews. But it turned out to be great training for a job in journalism, because when you're always the new kid, you learn how to read a room and empathize with people. And so I have best friends in deep red Oklahoma and bright blue Malibu, you know, and my mom really instilled this sense of constant courage and reinvention. Like, you don't like it here? A new future is right over, it's just a U-Haul rental away, you know, and very American sense of, you know, nomadic pursuit of happiness. Hers was sort of filtered through her faith, but it instilled me with that sense of, you know, wonder and curiosity, and also made me get bored very easily. So there's all kinds of issues that come with this, the neurotic. But anyway, I got thrown out of a Bible college in Oklahoma as a freshman for radically drinking and dancing. It was very much like a true life Footloose story. And amazing. I looked around and realized I'm 18 years old and I'm in Oklahoma. I could go anywhere. And I applied to Hawaii, Miami, and Pepperdine because they all offered surfing. I had this romantic beach thing going. And I got into Pepperdine, where they have a great little student journalism program and a TV station, radio station. I sort of fell in love with that. And I couldn't decide if I wanted to be David Letterman or Peter Jennings, the esteemed ABC News anchor. And but I chose the funny route. I enjoyed humor and sports, hung out with the sports teams. And so I started as a small market sportscaster and worked my way up from tiny markets in Minnesota to Green Bay, and then Chicago, where I became a morning show anchor there. And while I was sort of the courtside reporter for the Bulls championship runs, Michael Jordan's last 3 years. And then I went from there to LA and was a sports guy for a couple of years. But I got really bored with that after a while. The novelty wore off. You get very little sympathy bitching about going to Laker games and sitting on the front row. But I wanted to do other things. I had sort of a voracious appetite for news. And then when 9/11 happened, they sent me home for a couple of weeks because I was the goofy sports guy. And that was a real crossroads. And I thought, well, maybe I'll leave local news altogether and go into scripted world. I was living in LA and I sold a couple screenplays. And that's when I really sort of studying. I'd always admired writers. I read All the President's Men at a pretty young age, and sort of the idea of shoe leather journalism and great writing. And Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson were, you know, changing journalism at the time. And I sort of fell in love with that idea. But when I got a chance to step away from local news, and I thought I wanted to go into the scripted world, I really wanted to understand it. So I went to some screenwriting seminars with a story guru by the name of Robert McKee, who will, over 3 days, sort of break down. Takes 8 hours to watch Casablanca and understand the choices there and why it works and why the math and the physics of storytelling and why the brains of Homo sapiens are really built for efficiency around stories. And so that greatly influenced everything after that, because all my pilots got killed. Nothing got picked up. I realized that nothing in Hollywood ever really gets made. I missed being on TV every day and at least seeing my work on the air. And miraculously, ABC News called and they were starting Good Morning America Weekend, and the head of talent had found me in Chicago and kept tabs on me. And so I got this amazing opportunity to become a network correspondent and really actually work with Peter Jennings, my hero. And some of those lessons of writing apply. I tried to carry over into my writing for broadcast. Even for a 2-minute piece, you can use the same kind of rules. And, you know, 10 years at ABC, I moved over to CNN about a little over 10 years ago, and was going to be just a primetime anchor. So I was gunning for, but got the opportunity after Anthony Bourdain came to do his show here. They wanted more sort of exploratory travel documentary series. And I knew exactly what I wanted to do and pitched a show. I looked at my daughter. I realized she's going to turn my age in the year 2050. So I want to go to the wonders of the world and wonder what will be left of them, how they're changing, what are the threats, how they're managing places from becoming love to death. And so some angles, you know, were social changes or political, some were environmental. And so we shot around all around the world with that. And then the election changed the sort of CNN landscape in 2016. And they created the first climate desk, really, in network news. And I had resisted a beat for a long time. I'm a generalist. I like politics and entertainment and everything in between. But I realized this beat, climate, is the one beat that includes everything. You know, it's not just a menu item for pollsters when elections come up. It's the whole restaurant. It's, you know, economics, foreign policy, healthcare, food, travel, transportation, all is connected to a planet in balance and this incredible, you know, industrial revolution we're going through right now as the world electrifies and tries to fix this looming challenge. And so I leapt at it, and then I became a new old dad. My daughter was 16 in 2020, and to our joy, my partner got pregnant, and my little boy River was born at the height of the pandemic. And it just, I was weird. I'd hold him and look out at a world in lockdown. And I went and was covering the George Floyd protests after all of that upheaval, and just were like living through this revolution and pandemic and so much uncertainty. And so I started writing these Earth Day letters to my newborn about, hey, sorry that we broke the sea and the sky. Sorry that we've shortened the wings of the nightingale. But I'm still so glad you're here. And we need help. We need helpers these days. And I started, these letters transformed into this book in which, you know, the title is based on the thought that life as I knew it growing up is gone. It's over. The Goldilocks Earth we grew up on, we're beyond that. Nobody knows for sure how this new planet works. But life as we know it can be is already being proven around the world is healthier and happier and more connected and more resilient. And so I've all my travels gathering stories of just inspirational folks looking for secrets of societies. What's their magic mix that makes them live longer and have better mental health, physical health, and just distilling these lessons into sort of a manual for my boy to read at some point when he has to think about where to live and what kind of house to build and what kind of food supply will look like, you know, in the middle of this century. And I also tapped into sort of lessons from the giants in psychology, because I don't think we talk about the psychology of this crisis enough. And from Abraham Maslow and the Pyramid of Needs to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the 5 stages of grief, I sort of appropriated those for the climate audience and just thinking about, you know, the grief that we are going through, realizing the changes, even in our own hometowns that we haven't left, that they're changing so dramatically. And you know, rallying around each other and nature, looking for the best solutions. And I came away, I was supposed to turn this book in a couple of years ago. and I'm glad a lot of events, you know, and my natural procrastination and lazy self kicked it down the road, because it's a much more helpful book. There's enough policy things happen, enough innovations happen in the last couple of years that I wake with more wonder than worry these days. I'm just trying to start a conversation around wants and needs at this level. And it's easier for me to preach it to my kid.
Yeah. That's a great way to frame it, really. Yeah. Congrats on the work. Life as we know it can be. Talk a little bit about, yeah, I mean, you touched on it, but yeah, the fact that can be is in parentheses is kind of telling and a little bit chilling, but also hopeful, as you put it, because you've been on the front lines. You've seen more of these kind of, again, warnings and breakthroughs than most people. And, you know, obviously that's shaped you as a writer also. And as you put it, as a storyteller, it's going to deeply impact the everything that you do. Yeah, as a writer now with this debut, how does it feel? I mean, your peers have come out of the woodworks to blurb it, which is really cool to see. And I'll just say that Dan Buettner, of course, who has been on this show as well, called you one of America's great storytellers and called it a very timely debut. His work is amazing.
Yeah, I'm very fond of Dan in the Blue Zones. He's included in the book as well. I got a very kind blurb from Jonathan Safran Foer too.
Yeah.
And so it's so gratifying. I mean, as a first timer, you don't know if your baby's ugly, right? You know, and it's you. People are kind, you know, when you ask for folks to read. Well, I did. I reached out to folks like Dan and others and just said, "Will you look at these pages?" But boy, nothing teaches you about yourself like a book. I have such new respect for the authors I revered before. And again, like I said, it took me 2 years longer than it should have. And I would collect, you know, writing techniques, you know, bits of lore, like how, you know, John Cheever would put on a suit and then go down to the basement and take off the suit and sit there until he had his pages, right? Or Demosthenes in the Greek days would shave half his head because he would be embarrassed to go out until he was finished with the manuscript. like just these hilarious. There's one of the great writers at The Simpsons had what he called the crappy elf method, in which he imagines he falls asleep and a crappy elf sneaks into his writing table and knocks out a draft, like the like the folklore, you know, cobbler's assistant of days of yore. Because rewriting is much easier than writing. And so, you know, he just bangs out. Homer walks in the room and says, blah, blah, blah. And then so he can go back the next day and it's much easier to revise. So I tried all these ideas. But in the end, I know why they call Irish whiskey writer's tears. You know,
that's amazing. Yes. Well, of course, you got some really sweet blurbs from Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper, and that's got to feel pretty good. Yeah, with your debut, you know, really described as taking readers through time and around our changing world to confront the biggest threats to life as we know it and search for proven ways to build happier, healthier, and more resilient communities, come what may. Yeah, it's super interesting timing, as you put it. You know, we've talked quite a bit about these kind of concentric circles of crises, as we call them,
yeah,
that we've all been witnessing of late. And you know, you put it into, you know, in the writing of your prologue, some very apropos, yeah, kind of a capsule, if you will, of where we are. But then, yeah, I found it fascinating that this was inspired as kind of the letter to the future, as you put it. But yeah, again, congrats on the work, and talk a little bit about, I don't know, how you're feeling right now, because we missed you on Monday because you were covering, of course, this for some kind of a lifetime event, this eclipse that we had. And then, yeah, how you're feeling now, kind of approaching this launch of your baby.
Well, it's gratifying that people are finally getting a chance to read it and talking to podcasters who have read it. The feedback has been really, really encouraging. The eclipse coverage we did was actually a really inspiring day. It was nice to, I loved delving into the science behind that, the solar storm warnings that we don't ever talk about, the new breakthroughs that NASA is hoping to find that can only be studied during these total eclipses. And I was among the anchor team in Atlanta, so I wasn't out under it. But to watch folks, and a big theme of my book is trying to connect with each other around nature. And we're so sort of disconnected. We've created, our big brains have created, you know, a golden age of distraction and mm-hmm. addiction to screens and dopamine hits, you know, from a virtual world. When we evolved really to commune with each other around natural events like an eclipse And, you know, ancient civilizations interpreted it in different ways and maybe carved it into rock. And we're still just as fascinated. We have better tools to record it and study it. But anything that gets sort of science education, a real sense of something that's bigger than us, and get each other connected around these things, I think is huge. And now more than ever. And we live in really uncertain times globally. You know, when I was growing up, the environmental motto was think globally, act locally. And these days, if you think too much globally, you want to climb into a bong or a bottle. You know, it's just so depressing. But I argue that at times like these are when it's especially important for us to activate locally and think locally and connect locally around our watershed, wherever we happen to be, if on a coastal community, how are the mangroves doing? What's in our air where we live, and connecting with neighbors around these questions and sort of working around stuff at the bottom of our pyramid of needs together that will fill us with the love and esteem needs that we're craving at yoga camps and, you know, with virtual likes from strangers on social media. And so, you know, anything that lights that up in other people who recognize that, other parents who are really trying to instill this in their kids and get them connected with the favorite hiking trails or whatever. You know, the book is now, after just like all authors before me have experienced, you go into isolation and you craft this thing. But now that people are actually talking about the ideas that I was wrestling with alone for so long, it feels really good, you know, and we need each other more than ever. People can be a huge pain in the ass, as we know, and we've created this frictionless way to avoid folks and put in our earbuds and look away. I'm a natural introvert, so it's hard sometimes, but I'm hoping that this inspires a 1% more connection among the folks who read it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it will. I mean, it can't not with the kind of message and yeah, I mean, I would love to talk a little bit more. You had mentioned, you know, just some inspiration. Of course, you've mentioned some other authors that inspired the work, and your writing is kind of singular in its voice because of obviously these things that have shaped you. But yeah, talk a little bit about kind of crafting the work. And as you said, as a natural procrastinator, and what writer really isn't a procrastinator at its core, but, talk a little bit about, how you put it all together, because you know, with a lifetime of kind of like running up against these stories, it must've been tempting to kind of include a lot more than is actually here. Right.
Yeah. I mean, early drafts were, I'm not an outliner by nature. I write for the screen most days, and so and for the ear, and so it's half the writing is sort of done in the tracking booth as I start to say it out loud and find the rhythm, and I'm writing to pictures. But when you're just purely writing for the page, and without having the discipline of an outliner like better authors than me would have, I'm like a guy lost in the dark woods with a dying flashlight. I'm just sort of looking around for the trail and, oh, no, this is a dead end. And I'm, oh, there's something over here. And so probably 30, 40,000 words I wrote that were worthless in the end. They found their way in, they infused themselves sort of into ideas here and there. But part of the book, you know, the book is sort of undefinable in a way, in that it's a mashup of, there's some biography in it and there's some history.
Yeah.
And there's reportage from around the world, disaster zone stories, recovery stories. There's practical ideas that I've found on everything from how to build, you know, more efficient homes to food supplies to the idea that a hamburger can actually be better for the planet than a veggie burger. It depends on how you grow each. And, you know, so a lot of complicated different things, genres sort of mashed up together in the end. And the letter to River, my son, and later in the book to Olivia, my daughter, I think gives me some license to bounce around. But in the end, all of it, whether it's a history lesson about the guy who discovered oxygen, or whether it's a story of my mom dragging me around the country based on her dreams, they feed into the same ideas about the world we've built and the stories we tell ourselves and how we fill our pyramid of needs, how those effects ripple out into energy streams and waste streams and consumption patterns. And that, you know, times 8 billion people can break a planet, you know, depending on the kind of stories we're telling each other. And I was raised by both a mom who lived in really a world of magical thinking and a dad who was very much grounded in history and science. And both of those worldviews are valuable in some way, you know, and it's not until you get to be an old man like me with a couple of kids that you can sort of connect the dots backwards.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. Wow. And a truly unique take, but just a very timely one. And again, congrats.
Thank you.
Life as we know it can be stories of people, climate, and hope in a changing world. Again, just, a truly singular kind of work. And I think it will be kind of indelible to this moment because, as I said, it's just extremely timely.
I think it's one of those things, this topic, it was an interesting, fascinating study. Like one of the things that gave me infused me with some hope, because as I said, it would have been a much darker book if I had stayed in the mindset I was covering climate full time for the first couple of years. Because when you just drink from this fire hose of peer reviewed dread that science is providing now, species that are blinking out or entire places that are being degraded, it can be super dark. But the more I focused on the dreamers and the doers, the folks who are really thinking about these problems in practical ways and how to address them and move forward, it gave me a lot of hope. And then I read something, a term that I learned called pluralistic ignorance. It's the fact that you think that other Americans are opposed to you on these ideas. And in 2022, researchers from a number of colleges, including Yale, asked the average American to guess what percentage of your countrymen and women care about the climate changing, care about meaningful action. Most guessed between 33 and 40%. In reality, it's 66 to 80%. People think they're outnumbered 2 to 1. The opposite is true, because similar study found that even people who care about this topic rarely talk about it. It's been so politicized and it's so loaded and fraught that you don't want to be the buzzkill at the cocktail party or at the parent teacher drop off or whatever, you know. And whereas I think, boy, we need to be talking about this stuff more than ever. And it doesn't have to be framed even with the words climate change. It could just be about, hey, did you read a story about how they have electric school buses now? Wouldn't that be cool if our kids, you know, weren't breathing these fumes and the school could plug into the bus and light their classroom after, you know? Just Dr. Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. And not enough discussion, I think, around the future is what could be and what tools we already have to make things better. And it's just a matter of sharing that story.
Yeah, 100%. And thank you for doing that. It's got to be a kind of a truly an honor to be the first chief climate correspondent on network news. But what was that? Was that like a shock to you, or is it kind of like a mantle that you took?
No, like, I took it. I mean, look, I was at ABC News back in 2000, I want to say 6, 7, when Al Gore and scientists from the IPCC won the Nobel Prize and Inconvenient Truth won the Oscar. And the country and belatedly was finally talking about the story in a big way. And we did a 2-hour Earth Day special. We had a correspondent live on every continent. I was underwater over the Great Barrier Reef, and Diane Sawyer turned out the lights in Times Square as this symbolic moment. And I thought at that point, you know, the story had really taken root. But Bear Stearns crashed, the Great Recession happened, Barack Obama, you know, put a lot of his political capital into healthcare. And the moment when it was Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi shot a PSA sitting together talking about climate legislation. Those days went away and it became even more politicized since then. But now it's undeniable. You know, 2023 was so off the charts warm, and the events were so common and expensive now that the people who are hardline deniers for either politics or profit for years can't be that anymore. There's just no denying it. Now the conversation is more about, well, maybe it's too late to do anything. You know, human nature now will have as much to do with our futures as nature itself and physics around a warmer atmosphere, I think. And so I like to argue, and the thing I do every time I do a report on CNN about we just broke another record is to say, yes, this is the hottest March ever recorded, ever. Scientists think we're living through the hottest period in 120,000 years. But this is also one of the coolest marches of the rest of your life. And these are just the opening attractions. And so we have to brace for what is already sort of baked in. And now is the time when the skies are relatively clear to rally around each other and make plans. And some communities are doing that much more than others. And they're building seawalls in Charleston and raising streets in Miami. And, you know, insurance markets are roiling in California and Florida, just reacting to all of this in real time. And so kind of the way every reporter in every newsroom during COVID became a health reporter and had to suddenly understand virology, I argue that we're all climate reporters, whether we call ourselves that yet or not. And again, because it connects to so many stories on the business desk, on the politics desk. And I'm proud to be at a place that understands this early, you know, and gives the story much more air and space than it gets in most places.
Amazing. Well, we really do appreciate it and appreciate your work. And thank you very much for taking the time to do this and wrap with us about life as we know it can be. Yeah. What's next for you? Where are you headed? I know you probably have some events planned in the future, but I know you're working hard at your other things.
Yeah. No, my day job is going to keep me busy heading into hurricane season. We're shooting a special hour for the whole story with Anderson Cooper, our Sunday night magazine show, on the themes of the book, on sort of Adaptation Nation, how the way we build homes and buildings is changing in really amazing and exciting ways, the way we grow food. And that'll come out sometime in the summer. And I'm just generally, I might pop up on a TV on an airport near you at some point between now and then. But I'm lucky enough to cover the country and the world. And it's, I think, one of the best jobs.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you, your words, your wisdom, of course. Life as we know it can be. I will point at the book and all of the things. And as mentioned, this is just a very timely book. And also, as I had read it, a great gift, right? For be it the social activists. Now that we are all climate reporters, global wanderers, the scientifically curious, the climate defender, and more. But yeah, man, appreciate you. Come back anytime.
Thank you, Kelton.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.